There are many factors that contribute to your total well-being. In this volume, Dr. Chopra focuses on creating and maintaining a healthy body, while focusing on modern-day debilitating disease, specifically diabetes. He continues by exploring the three doshas and what actions individuals within each of these body constitutions can take to aid themselves in their healing process. He also goes in depth into the influences that two senses, taste and smell, can have on improving your health. And finally, Dr. Chopra demystifies some of the most common misconceptions about the body-mind connection in the segment entitled, The 10 New Assumptions About the Body.
A little less than 100 years ago, science embarked on a fundamental redefinition, not just of our world, but of the universe itself. The new reality, revealed by quantum physics, made it possible for the first time to manipulate the invisible intelligence that underlies the visible environment. Einstein taught us that the physical body, like all material objects, is an illusion, and that trusting our senses to delineate the real world can be like grasping a shadow and missing the substance. Because the unseen world is the real world, and when we are willing to explore that unseen world of our bodies, we can tap into the immense creative power that lies at our source. As we discuss these 10 assumptions one by one in light of the revolutionary insights of quantum physics, I think you'll begin to see the world and your place in it in a new and exciting way. Number one, there is no objective world independent of the observer. The world you accept as real seems to have definite qualities, yet none of these qualities means anything aside from your perception. Take any object, such as a chair. To you, the chair isn't very large, but to an ant, it is immense. To you, the chair feels hard, but a neutrino would whiz through it without slowing down, because a neutrino is so minute that the chair's atoms are miles apart. Likewise, anything else you can describe about the chair can be completely altered simply by changing your perception. Because there are no absolute qualities to anything in the material world, it is false to say that there is even an independent world out there. All that is really out there is raw, unformed data, waiting to be interpreted by you, the observer, the perceiver. None of the objective facts upon which we usually base our reality is fundamentally valid. As disturbing as this may sound, there is incredible liberation in realizing that you can change your world, including your body, simply by changing your perception. All the various age changes that you are experiencing are the result of frozen bits of old perception. Your cells are imprinted with conditioned responses that took on physical form. Old cells are maps of a person's experience. Things that made you suffer are imprinted there, along with things that brought you joy, still sending out signals like buried microchips, making you anxious, tense, fatigued. These reactions cross the mind-body barrier to become part of you. 100 things you pay no attention to, breathing, digesting, growing new cells, keep going on ceaselessly. These automatic processes play a huge part in aging, for as we age, our ability to coordinate these functions declines. A lifetime of unconscious living leads to numerous deteriorations, while a lifetime of conscious participation prevents them. If you learn to pay conscious attention to bodily functions, instead of leaving them on automatic pilot, the very act of paying attention would change how you age. Every so-called involuntary function can be consciously controlled. The era of biofeedback and meditation has taught us that. Heart patients have been trained in mind-body laboratories to lower their blood pressure at will. Why not turn this ability to use in the aging process? There are abundant techniques, as we will see, for influencing the so-called involuntary nervous system to our advantage. 2. Our bodies are composed of energy and information. To transform the patterns of the past, it's necessary to know what they are made of. Your body appears to be composed of solid matter that can be broken down into molecules and atoms. But quantum physics tells us that every atom is more than 99.999% empty space. And the subatomic particles moving at lightning speed through this huge space are actually bundles of vibrating energy. The essential stuff of the universe, including your body, is non-stuff. But it isn't ordinary non-stuff, it is thinking non-stuff. The void inside every atom is pulsating with unseen intelligence. Geneticists locate this intelligence primarily inside DNA, but that is only for convenience sake. Life unfolds as DNA imparts its coded intelligence to its active twin, RNA, which in turn goes out into the cell and imparts bits of intelligence to thousands of enzymes, which then use their specific bit of intelligence to make proteins. At every point in this sequence, energy and information have to be exchanged, or otherwise, there could be no building life from lifeless matter. As marvelous as this wealth of diverse intelligences, at bottom, there is only one single intelligence shared by the whole body. As we age, this flow of intelligence becomes compromised in various ways. The specific intelligence of the immune system, the nervous system, and the endocrine system all start falling off. Age deterioration would be unavoidable if the body was simply material, because all material things are prey to entropy, the tendency of orderly systems to become disorderly. But entropy doesn't apply to intelligence. An invisible part of us is immune to the ravages of time. Modern science is just discovering the implications of all this, but it has been imparted for centuries through spiritual traditions in which masters have preserved the youthfulness of their bodies far into old age. In India, the flow of intelligence is called prana, usually translated as life force, which can be manipulated to keep the physical body orderly and young. As we will see, the ability to contact and use prana is open to all of us. 3, mind and body are inseparably one. Intelligence is much more flexible than the mask of matter which hides it. Intelligence can express itself either as thoughts or as molecules. A basic emotion like fear can be described as an abstract feeling or as a tangible molecule of the hormone adrenaline. Without the feeling, there's no hormone. Without the hormone, there's no feeling. The revolution we call mind-body medicine was based on this simple discovery. Wherever a thought goes, a chemical goes with it. Medicine is just beginning to use the mind-body connection for healing, using placebos or dummy drugs to kill pain, to stop excessive gastric secretions in ulcer patients, to lower blood pressure, or fight tumors. Since the same inert pill can lead to such totally different responses, we have to conclude that the body is capable of producing its own biochemical response once the mind has been given the appropriate suggestion. The pill itself is meaningless. The power that activates the placebo effect is the power of suggestion alone. This suggestion gets converted into the body's intention to cure itself. Therefore, why not bypass the deception of the sugar pill and go directly to the intention? If we could effectively trigger the intention not to age, the body would carry it out automatically. The decline of vigor in old age is largely the result of people expecting to decline. They have unwittingly implanted a self-defeating intention in the form of a strong belief, and the mind-body connection automatically carries this intention out. Long before you get old, you can prevent losses by consciously programming your mind to remain youthful using the power of your intention. 4. The biochemistry of the body is a product of awareness. Healing cannot be understood unless someone's beliefs, assumptions, expectations, and self-image are also understood. Although the image of the body as a mindless machine continues to dominate mainstream medicine, there is unquestionable evidence to the contrary. Death rates from cancer and heart disease are provably higher among people in psychological distress and lower among people who have a strong sense of purpose and well-being. What the new paradigm teaches us is that emotions are expressions of awareness, the fundamental stuff of life. Awareness makes a huge difference in aging. To despair of growing old makes you grow old faster. To accept it with grace keeps many miseries, both physical and mental, from your door. The common sense notion of you're only as old as you think you are has deep implications. Number 5. Perception is a learned phenomenon. Perceptions of love, hatred, delight, and nausea stimulate the body in extremely different directions. In short, our bodies are the physical result of all the interpretations we have been learning to make since we were born. Your cells are constantly processing experience and metabolizing it according to your personal views. You don't just funnel raw data through your eyes and ears and stamp it with a judgment. You physically turn into the interpretation as you internalize it. Someone who is depressed over losing his job is projecting sadness everywhere in his body. Hormone levels change, the sleep cycle is interrupted, and even his tears contain different chemicals than tears of joy. This whole biochemical profile will alter dramatically when the person finds a new job and the body's output of hormones, receptors, and even the expression of DNA itself will start to reflect the sudden turn for the better. This point reinforces the great need to use our awareness to create the bodies we actually want. Anxiety over a lost job passes, but the aging process has to be countered every day. Your interpretation of how you are aging is critical to what happens over the next 4, 5, or 6 decades. There is no biochemistry outside awareness. Once you learn to accept that fact, the whole illusion of being victimized by a mindless, randomly degenerating body falls away. 6. Impulses of intelligence constantly create the body in new forms every second. Creating the body in new forms is necessary in order to meet the changing demands of life. As long as new perceptions continue to enter your brain, your body can respond in new ways. There is no secret of youth more powerful. New knowledge, new skills, new ways of looking at the world keep mind and body growing, and as long as that happens, the natural tendency to be new at every second is expressed. In place of the belief that the body decays with time, nurture the belief that the body is new at every second. In place of the belief that the body is a mindless machine, nurture the belief that the body is infused with the deep intelligence of life, whose sole purpose is to sustain you. These new beliefs are not just nicer to live with, they are true. We experience the joy of life through our bodies. Therefore, it is only natural to believe that our bodies are not set against us, but want what we want. So this session is about mind-body interactions in diabetes. One of the things that got me interested in the whole field of consciousness-based medicine, because my own personal training was first in internal medicine, and then after that I was a fellow in metabolism and diabetes and endocrinology at Harvard and at the Joslin Clinic, which is probably the world's premier place for complicated diabetic situations. And if anyone in this country has very severe complicated diabetes with complications such as blindness or kidney disease, difficult to control diabetes, and they have the resources, they usually end up in Joslin Clinic in Boston. And I was a fellow over there, and I would sometimes be totally perplexed because you'd see two people who had the same kind of diabetes getting the same kind of treatment, and yet one person would be blind, have severe kidney disease, need a kidney transplant or be on a dialysis machine, and then the other person, same age, same disease, same kind of diabetes, same kind of treatment, was doing completely well. No blindness, no kidney disease, and extraordinarily good health. When I saw that, that was the first time I began to wonder, you know, how come you can give the same kind of treatment to two people with exactly the same disease and see completely different outcomes? This is not just diabetes. It's true of many diseases. Heart disease, you have two patients with the same degree of myocardial infarction, and one gets all kinds of complications and dies in the coronary care unit, and the other recovers and goes home. So there is much more to medicine than we think. We've been taught to think that all illness is due to a pathogenic agent. A pathogen, whether it's a virus or a bacteria or a carcinogen or some kind of trauma, causes the disease. Well, it turns out that's not the case. A pathogen never causes the disease. A pathogen may be a precipitating factor in a susceptible host. And what makes one person more susceptible and what makes another person more resistant to the same onslaught from the environment is sometimes what makes the difference between life and death. So diabetes is the Latin name is Asa Diracta Indica. It's very common in India. You actually can make a little concoction out of it and you drink it. It's very bitter and it has an effect on insulin receptor sites. And the third herb that is used is called gugul. And we use gugul for many, many reasons. What is gugul? It's a resin. It does not get absorbed into the system. And it's one of the most frequently used preparations in Ayurveda for lowering cholesterol. And very effective. I have had cardiologists, given them samples, said cholesterol is a very difficult thing to treat. And the drugs that are used are pretty toxic. And yet gugul will reduce as effectively as any drug, and sometimes even more, with no toxicity. And the beauty is it's not absorbed. So it has no toxicity whatsoever. Gugul is used for treatment of high cholesterol. It's also used for treatment of heart disease in combination with other herbs. We have a preparation here called OptiCardio, which contains gugul and other things that are tonics for the heart, but the main effect is again lowering cholesterol. And there is another preparation, the commercial name is Gugul Max. Okay, so that's probably one of the best things you can use for lowering cholesterol as well. Okay, then there's another herb called Gokshura, which is also... And when you have lack of insulin, then your blood sugar goes up. And if it goes up a lot, then it spills into the urine. And now there's evidence that it gets transferred into some toxic kinds of metabolites, which then damage things like eyes, kidneys, nerves, blood vessels. So diabetes is the most common cause for blindness. It's also the most common cause for kidney failure. The most common cause why people have to go in dialysis or get kidney transplants. It's also a very high risk factor for atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. It's also a risk factor for heart disease or people getting heart attacks. And type 1 diabetes is the kind of diabetes that people get when they have lack of insulin. And this lack of insulin usually manifest in young life. And if people have type 1 diabetes before the 1930s, before insulin was discovered, then they would die in their youth. They would die in their 20s. Since insulin has been discovered, of course, people do survive, but they still go on to develop heart disease and blindness and kidney disease and neuropathy and atherosclerosis, frequently need to have their limbs amputated. So the complications of diabetes are horrendous. In fact, in medical school we were taught that if you understood everything that goes with diabetes, then you start to know everything in medicine, because it affects every system in the body. It affects your cardiovascular system, it affects your eyes, it affects kidneys, it affects the nerves, it affects muscle, it causes damage almost everywhere. And if you really understood all that happens with diabetes, you probably understand everything that could possibly go wrong in the human body. The cause of type 1 diabetes is now known. There's first of all a genetic predisposition to it. If there are identical twins and one has diabetes, then it's 50% likely that the identical twin will also have it. But not 100%. That tells us something too. Why only 50% if they're identical twins? So there must be something in the environment that predisposes people to that. And it's now felt that that something in the environment is some kind of infection in youth, a viral infection, possibly even something as simple as mumps or some other virus, influenza, mumps, that causes some kind of damage in the system. It results in what is called an autoimmune reaction, where there are antibodies that build up in the system to the islet cells. Islet cells are cells in the pancreas which produce insulin. So they start destroying these islet cells, and then you have an insulin deficiency. In fact, there are now tests that people can do, antibody tests, in children, and with reasonable accuracy you can predict that this child may develop diabetes in the future if they get an infection, a viral infection. And you know, viral infections are pretty common and easy to get. It used to also be thought, and wasn't clear, at least when I was taking my training, is the damage that happens in diabetes directly due to blood sugar, or is it something, some other metabolic disorder? And now more and more people believe that the damage that happens in the body is actually directly related to the blood sugar level. So the more control you have, the more you can maintain blood sugar within normal levels or close to normal levels, the less likely it is that you will get these complications. So that's type 1 diabetes. It's not as common as the other kind of diabetes, which is type 2 diabetes, which is also called maturity onset diabetes, because it occurs in later life. It occurs usually in the late 30s or 40s or even later. And maturity onset diabetes happens to be a completely different kind of disease. Here, instead of too little insulin, there is too much insulin. But it doesn't work. For some reason, even though there's a lot of insulin in the body, it's not working effectively. And over the last several years, last couple of decades, it's become clear that what's happened in these cases is that there is a resistance at the level of the cell to insulin. So there is insulin resistance. The receptor that binds insulin, remember, a receptor is like this lock into which your key fits. So think of insulin as the key that opens the door to a cell, which has to then metabolize glucose. The insulin, which is a neuropeptide, does not fit into the receptor for some reason. Most people with type 2 diabetes also have obesity. They're heavy. They are overweight. And if they lose weight and achieve normal weight, then the diabetes goes away.
and they do reasonably well. So there's a direct link between obesity and type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. How obesity creates insulin resistance, no one knows. There's too much insulin. Now, if type 2 diabetes is left untreated, it has the same, if not more, incidence of complications than type 1. It's as dangerous. It can lead to blindness, leads to kidney failure, leads to heart attacks, leads to atherosclerosis, leads to aneurysms, leads to hypertension, leads to neuropathy. People might have to get their limbs amputated. There is no difference in the rate of complications with type 2 diabetes. It's a bad disease, really bad disease. And yet, in a sense, unlike type 1 diabetes, traditional medicine holds that type 2 diabetes is curable if obesity could be curable. But of course, obesity is also a very difficult thing and frustrating thing to treat. Type 1 diabetes is also called insulin-dependent diabetes because anyone with type 1 diabetes usually needs insulin injections, not only once a day, but several times a day in order to maintain the blood sugar close to normal levels since there's insulin deficiency. Type 2 diabetes is not insulin-dependent because you already have a lot of insulin. It just doesn't work. So if you give somebody lots of insulin, it doesn't do anything in type 2 diabetes. And in fact, if somebody has type 2 diabetes for a long, long time, and the pancreas then gets exhausted, it puts out all this insulin, it doesn't work, and ultimately type 2 diabetes can lead to insulin deficiency also, and start behaving like type 1 diabetes. There is an 80% incidence of diabetes in identical twins. So if one person has diabetes and the identical twin has an 80% likelihood. So it's even more genetically determined than type 1 diabetes. And then there's something called type 3 diabetes, which is also called maturity onset diabetes in the young, which means the person who gets it is a young person, even a teenager, but it behaves like type 2 diabetes. They're obese, they are insulin resistant. And type 3 diabetes is found in India very frequently. It's also found amongst the American Indian tribes, particularly the Pima Indians. And in Pima Indians, the incidence is so high, it's about 60 to 70% of the Pima Indian population in Arizona has type 2 diabetes, which is insulin-resistant diabetes occurring at a young age. Same incidence of complications. So, it's a huge kind of problem. It's one of the commonest risk factors for heart disease as well. The sensory experience I want to discuss is the experience of taste. After all, that's one of the most enjoyable experiences in life. When people get underweight or they get overweight, the reason that happens is they've stopped enjoying food. If we enjoy food, then we'll never have a weight problem. In fact, I'm going to suggest a few techniques that if you follow these techniques, and they have to do with eating awareness, you'll never have a weight problem, ever. So these are really very simple things that one does to maximize one's enjoyment of food. Note these simple techniques of eating awareness. The first one, whenever you eat, no matter how much or how little, doesn't matter. It could be one scoop of ice cream or one peanut or one sip of coffee, anything. Whenever you eat or drink anything other than water, make a rule that you're going to sit down to do that. So always sit down. Preferably, there should be a chair and a table. Don't eat when you're standing. Don't eat when you're driving. Don't eat when you're walking. Don't eat when you're speaking on the phone, etc. Why would you want to? After all, eating is an enjoyable thing. might as well do it in an enjoyable manner, so you get the maximum out of the experience. Number two, when you eat, don't do anything else. In other words, it's best not to read a newspaper or watch a television program or read a book or try and do a crossword puzzle or watch the evening news or even listen to music, because you want to get the maximum out of the sensory experience of taste when you're eating. That's what makes it enjoyable. Rule number three, eat when the stomach is empty. That is, there is no remnant from a previously eaten meal in the stomach, because that too would interfere with the enjoyment of food. See, what we're doing with all these very simple rules is we are maximizing the enjoyment we could get from the experience of eating. Now, according to basic rules of physiology, it's
control can be achieved. And type 2 diabetes, excellent control can be achieved. Type 2 diabetes is much more common, has the same incidence of complications, therefore is a more important disease to treat. So the first herb that I want to talk about is called Meha Siringi in Sanskrit, and the Latin name is Gymnema Silvestre. It's the original name in Sanskrit means destroyer of sweet. And it's mentioned even in Sushruta's work thousands of years ago. And it's a very interesting herb. If you just take a little bit of it and put it on your tongue, you lose your sensation for sweetness for about an hour or 2 hours. Just by putting that herb on your tongue, I personally feel it's one of the most effective things for people who have sugar cravings, for people who have obesity and like to eat too many sweets, etc. So it's a very effective herb. You say, why isn't everybody using it? The answer is the pharmaceutical industry is not interested in this stuff because you can't patent it. You know, you cannot patent something that has too many ingredients. And so the pharmaceutical industry says there's no money in it. These things are very effective, okay? So it destroys the taste for sugar for a while. It decreases your appetite. It's useful in treatment of obesity. And in fact, there's some evidence that it may influence insulin receptor sites. The second herb that's used in Sanskrit, in Hindi, the name is neem. And
there's another threshold. Most people who have weight problems, they seek more intense stimulation from food simply because they do it unconsciously. They're dumping food into their stomach as if it was a garbage can. So as a result, it takes much longer for that satiety level to be reached. And therefore, they eat inappropriately. Now, one of the simple rules that I give my patients frequently is that for your first helping, take about 2 cupped hands full of food, the equivalent of 2 cupped hands. This will fill up about 2/3 of the stomach, leaving about 1/3 for digestion. If after that you still feel hungry, it may be genuine hunger, which means that you haven't eaten enough, or it may be just a memory. If it's just a memory and force of habit, all you have to do is wait for 5 minutes before you take a second helping. Frequently, those satiety levels will reach a certain critical threshold, and if you just wait for 5 minutes, the hunger will dissipate. You're not fighting the hunger, you're not manipulating it, all you're doing is waiting 5 minutes for the second helping. That's all. You should get in touch with the experience of comfort and discomfort in the area of the stomach. And at the point of comfort, you stop. If you go beyond the point of comfort, then obviously you're violating a simple rule of eating awareness. Why would you want to? It disrupts the feeling of energy. If you practice eating awareness even for 1 week, you will feel so much energy coming into you from the experience of eating that spontaneously you will want to follow these rules afterwards. Because the experience of energy gets a bit addictive. You get used to feeling so good, so energetic, that you don't want to violate it. You go to the range of discomfort in the stomach. First, there is a slight discomfort, then you feel tired, then you feel sleepy, and if you really violate it, then you feel quite sick. Many times, people will notice that even though they practice eating awareness, they have very strong cravings for certain types of food. And they can't resist those cravings. Now, according to the principles of Ayurveda, if we have very strong cravings, inappropriately strong cravings, in that we eat always to the point of discomfort, then we may have an eating disorder. But the etiology, or the cause of the eating disorder, has to do with, again, loss of ability to enjoy food. Traditionally, all food has six flavors to it. And what happens is, if your taste buds are not experiencing all the six tastes every day, then that causes imbalance in the body. After all, we have these taste buds for a certain purpose. The six tastes are the following: sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent, and astringent. It turns out that our taste buds are distributed in a certain manner. For example, the tip of the tongue is highly concentrated for sweet taste, the back of the tongue for bitter taste, sides of the tongue more receptors for sour taste, the surface of the tongue more receptive to salty taste. And then the two other tastes that I mentioned, pungent and astringent, there are very few receptors for this. And that's why pungent and astringent tastes are in fact quite characteristic, in that even a little bit of pungency has a lot of effect on the body. Also, sweet taste, even a dilution of 1 in 200 can be detected. A salty taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 400. A sour taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 130,000. And a bitter taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 2 million. And therefore, you can see that these tastes are in fact protective, because most poisonous things are extremely bitter. The taste buds can detect that even in a faint dilution of 1 in 2 million. So nature has built in these very protective mechanisms. And also, if we listen to the taste buds, then we'll see that we start enjoying food, the distribution is appropriate for our body types, and spontaneously there's balance in the body as well. One way to sensitize the taste buds is to swish a teaspoon of sesame oil in the oral cavity, in the mouth. This makes the taste buds much more sensitive. One can just swish it around gently for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then spit it out and just wash the mouth with plain water afterwards. This lubricates the taste buds, makes them much more sensitive. And when we have more of that experience of delicacy in food, then we tend not to overeat, because satiety levels are reached very easily. And basically, people who tend to overeat have what is called a high flavor threshold, in that they need much more intense stimulation from food because their taste buds are dull. So let's go over these six tastes, because what we see in our society is people concentrate just on three tastes: sweet, sour, and salt. Classic example, French fries and ketchup. In fact, think of any fast food and you'll see that it is sweet, sour, and salt. So what we do is, even though we have taste buds for all the six tastes, we constantly expose ourselves to just those three. As a result, the body gets nutritional deficiencies. The animals in the forest don't have the vaguest notion of what the US Surgeon General said was the minimum requirement for calcium or zinc or whatever. And yet, animals don't get nutritional deficiencies. Animals don't get osteoporosis. The only animal, the only species that gets obese is the human species. And that is because we have lost our ability to respond to internal cues. We are always responding to external cues. And what I'm trying to do here is shift our attention so that we begin to respond to internal cues that nature has built into our systems. So if you constantly expose yourself to sweet, sour, and salt, sweet, sour, and salt, then you get the cravings. Since you're used only to sweet, sour, and salt, you go ahead and take more sweet, sour, and salt. That aggravates the craving even more. The first thing to do when you have these cravings is to gently introduce all the six tastes, at least in one meal, every day. So the six tastes are sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent and astringent. When I say sweet, I don't mean concentrated sugar, which is bad for anyone. When I say the sweet taste, I just mean the sweet taste that is in things like breads, carbohydrates, rice, milk, cream, butter, even chicken, fish, meat. Their baseline taste is sweet. Sour is the taste that is dominant in things like lemon, in yogurt, cheese. Salt needs no explanation. Bitter is the taste of green leafy vegetables, spinach, broccoli, endives. All these have a bitter element to them. And then pungent is the taste of spices. For example, horseradish or mustard or just red peppers, black pepper, jalapenos, serrano, all these things that add spice to the food. So any spice is the taste pungent. An astringent taste is the characteristic taste in beans, lentils and pulses. So Mexican food, for example, when you eat beans or when you eat lentils or peas, that has a peculiar taste that's unique to itself. That is called the astringent taste. In other words, if your taste buds are exposed to all these six tastes, one meal, for example, where there would be some bread or rice, some green leafy vegetables, of course salt is there, some pungency in the form of some spices, and a little bit of beans or lentils, that would be the six tastes. Spontaneously, the cravings would dissipate because the body is exposing itself to what nature meant it to expose itself to. So, just introducing the six tastes to our food will immediately get rid of all the cravings. Now, it turns out that different foods will have different effects on different physiologies. For example, if you're feeling hyperactive, then the vata pacifying food will cause a settling down of that hyperactivity. On the other hand, if you're feeling hypoactive, lethargic, lazy, tend to gain weight, then a kapha pacifying food will speed up the metabolism of food. Vata pacifying foods are sweet, sour and salty. Pitta pacifying foods are astringent, bitter and sweet. And kapha pacifying foods are bitter, pungent and astringent. It's very interesting. You can, with a little bit of spice, little bit of mustard, little bit of horseradish or a little bit of other spices, speed up the body's metabolism by as much as 25%. So a person who has a weight problem, if he just takes a little extra food in the form of bitter, astringent and pungent tastes, that will alter his metabolism in such a way that it will make it easier for such a person to lose weight. There's no exercise that would increase the body's metabolism by 25%. And yet spices do that. That's why people start sweating, and that's why people have all kinds of reactions to spicy foods, because they speed up the metabolism. Now, it turns out that while these different tastes are affecting our physiology, they're also affecting our emotions and our psychology. Our language, in fact, reflects that. So we say, sweet love, sweet friends, sweet children, sweet memories. Or we say bitter enemy, bitter argument, bitter pain, bitter disappointment, bitter regret. Or we say, I'm still smarting, stinging, burning from his pungent remarks. Or we say, so-and-so has an astringent or caustic sense of humor, a dry wit. So we can see that food and the various tastes have an effect not only on our physiology, but on our emotions. And we can see just by changing our food, we can influence our emotions, we can influence our body's metabolism, we can influence it in such a way that we can either gain weight or lose weight just by paying a little more attention to a different sensory experience of taste.